We're going to hear today a talk with Brian Stevenson. He's the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. He's a professor at New York University School of Law, and he spoke earlier this year at the Lensic, sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. Here now, Brian Stevenson.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the work that I've been doing and the issues that surround it. And it's difficult sometimes to talk about this work because it raises very, very serious questions about what kind of country we live in, what kind of society we've created, what's happened to our commitment to fairness and equality. The United States is a very different country today than it was 40 years ago. In the last 40 years, something really radical has happened in this country and has changed this country in some very profound ways. The prison population in America in 1972 was 300,000 people, but today it is 2.3 million. And mass incarceration has fundamentally changed this country. Our country has been corrupted by the politics of fear and anger. And our politicians and policymakers have exploited that fear and anger, and we've done some devastating things to lots and lots of people. In many communities, 40, 50, 60% of the young men of color are in jail, in prison, on probation, or parole. We've created laws that have incredible collateral consequences. The Welfare Reform Act of 1996 actually created provisions that allows us to now ban people with drug convictions from public benefits. So during our lifetime, the United States Congress actually created a law that created a new class of person. And it's mostly women with children who are now our untouchables. These women cannot access the public housing. They cannot access food stamps. They can't get public medical services. They are on the margins of our society, legally excluded because of a prior drug crime. We've taken away people's right to vote. My state of Alabama, 34% of the black male population has permanently lost the right to vote. We're projecting in another decade there'll be parts of Alabama where the disenfranchisement among African-American men will be actually higher than it was before the passage of the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s. And still there is this appalling silence. And all of these data, the fact that we have the highest incarceration rate in the world, all of these statistics really haven't changed the way we think about what we're called to do when it comes to justice. And I wanted to talk tonight, reflect a little bit on the dynamics that I think allow us to confront injustice. For me, it becomes important to not simply educate myself about these problems, but to kind of figure out what do I have to do to position myself to be a better advocate, to be a better steward of protecting equal justice, to be a better citizen confronting inequality and unfairness. And I want to just talk about four things. And it may seem simply, it's not going to be terribly academic, but the first thing I want to talk about is actually proximity. I actually think to make a difference, to change the world in which we're living, we have to be willing to get closer to the problems that we see. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about the criminal justice system or mass incarceration, we're talking about the environment, or we're talking about poverty, we're talking about global warming. I think we have to get closer to the problems, because when you get close to a problem, you see things that you cannot otherwise see. You hear things, you pick up nuances that change the way you feel about that problem, the way you understand that problem. And so there's something important and powerful about being proximate. Now, I learned this not actually from the work that I do. I learned it a long time ago because I was struggling to figure out what I was going to do. I grew up in a poor rural community in the South and started my education in the colored schools. Black children in my community could not go to the public school. And I remember when lawyers came into our community to open up those schools, and I got close to an education system that was actually stronger, better. And that allowed me to go to college. And I went to college. I was a philosophy major in college, and I was very busy, you know, with music and sports and studying. I was just enjoying college so fully. And then I woke up one morning as a senior and for the first time realized that nobody was going to pay me to philosophize when I graduated. It was really quite a shock. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do? And my roommate said, you're going to have to get a job. I said, a job? And so I panicked and started thinking, well, where can I go to school after I finish college? And I started looking at all kinds of graduate programs. And to my great dismay, if you do graduate work in most substantive areas, history, political science, English, you actually have to know something about those substantive areas. That was pretty intimidating. And then I found law school. And I quickly learned you don't have to know anything to go to law school. So I energetically applied and went off to law school, ended up at Harvard Law School, and I was going to law school so happy I'd found a place to kind of do some time. And I have to say, I hated my first year of law school. Hated it. I was motivated to kind of study law because I was interested in race and poverty and inequality. And they were talking about torts and civil procedure and contracts and all of these things, and it felt very disconnected. And so I decided to do a joint degree, and I left the law school after the first year and went to the School of Government. And I thought, well, this is going to be a lot better. And I went to the School of Government, and I honestly hated that even more. They were teaching me to maximize benefits and minimize costs, and there was a lot of quantitative analysis, which I enjoyed, but at the end of it, it felt also very disconnected. And so I kind of went back to the law school. If I had to choose between these very unpleasant options, I would go to the less pleasant option. And I was kind of moving along until I had a chance to take a course that allowed me to spend a month in an organization doing human rights work. And that's how I went to Atlanta and met Steve Bright at Southern Center for Human Rights. And I got down there, and these lawyers were so engaged trying to save people's lives, people on death row. And I was energized by their activism, their commitment. And being proximate to it made me feel like, well, maybe there's something for me here. And then one day, they asked me to go to death row and meet someone on the row who they hadn't had a chance to go and talk to. And they said, well, Brian, we need you to go down and talk to this man. Just tell him that he's not at risk of execution any time in the next year. And I said, okay. And I was very excited to be going down there. And I came to the office the next day, and I said, well, which lawyer is going to come with me to death row? And they said, we can't spare a lawyer. You have to go by yourself. And then my excitement quickly turned into fear and panic. And I was just, really kind of nervous about this whole trip, drove down there, started rehearsing in my mind what I was going to say to this man on death row. And I tried to kind of figure out how to do it, but I was really terrified. I'd never been to death row before. I got to death row, got to the back, got pushed into this area where the visitation was going to take place. And I was just trying to rehearse what I was going to say. And this man was pushed into the room, an African-American man. He was in chains. He had handcuffs on. He had shackles. They slowly removed all these chains. And the man came over to me. And instead of saying what I'd rehearsed, I just started apologizing. I was really overwhelmed. Kept saying, I'm so sorry. I'm just a law student. I'm so sorry. I don't know very much. I'm so sorry. I can't probably answer any of your questions. I'm so sorry that I couldn't come with a lawyer. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And through my apologies, I finally got out that they had sent me down there to tell him that he was not at risk of execution any time in the next year. And as soon as I said that, this man grabbed my hands. He said, say that again. I said, you're not at risk of execution any time in the next year. And he closed his eyes and he said, say it one more time. I said, you're not at risk of execution any time in the next year. And he got very emotional. He says, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your being here. He said, I've been fretting when they were going to execute me. I haven't let my wife come and visit. I haven't let my kids come to visit. I didn't want them to come and have to deal with that. Now that you've come and told me this, I'm going to see my wife. I'm going to see my children. And he started thanking me. We fell into this conversation, and I couldn't believe how time started to pass. It turned out that he had exactly my birth date, same month, same day, same year. And we started talking, and 10 minutes turned into a half hour turned into an hour turned into 2 hours, 2 hours turned into 3 hours, and we were deep in conversation with one another. And when I looked up and I realized how long I had been there, I couldn't believe it because I felt so connected to this person. And I'd only scheduled 45 minutes for the visit, and a guard was angry that it had taken 3 hours. And he came into the visitation area, and he was very mad, and he said, you were in here way too long. And he couldn't really do anything to me, so he took it out on this man, and he started putting the handcuffs on really tightly. I tried to intervene. I said, look, I'm sorry. It's my fault that I stayed so long. He didn't do anything wrong. The guard was paying me no attention. And then he put the shackles on his ankle. He put the chain around his waist, and he was drawing the chain so tight that I could see this man grimacing. And I kept trying to get the guard to stop, but he couldn't deter him from all of this very aggressive behavior. And I kept apologizing. I said, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get you in trouble. And he kept saying to me, this man, don't worry, Brian. Just come back. I said, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to get you in trouble. He said, don't worry, Brian. Just come back. And they were picking up this man to take him back to death row, and they were pushing him toward the door. And I felt really terrible about how he was being treated. And I said one last time, I said, I'm sorry. And the man looked at me one last time, and I never will forget it. He looked at me and he said, Brian, don't worry about this. Just come back. And they started pushing him through the door, but before they could get him out, I saw him plant his feet so that when they pushed him, he didn't move. And then he looked at me, and I watched him slowly close his eyes, and he threw his head back, and he did something that completely shocked me that I've never forgotten. I watched this man while he closed his eyes, and he threw his head back, and with all those chains on, this man opened his mouth and started to sing. And he started singing this hymn I used to hear when I was a little boy growing up in church. He started singing, I'm pressing on the upward way. New heights I'm gaining every day. Still praying as I'm onward bound. Then he said, Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. And it startled everybody. He had a very strong voice. And the guards recovered and started pushing him down the hall. And he couldn't really walk with these chains on his ankles, but he kept singing. And I watched this man as he kept being pushed down the hall, singing this song, singing about getting to higher ground. And hearing him sing that song did something really profound to me. It said something to me about the power of redemption and grace. He was singing for me, he told me later, because he felt that he wanted to show me some compassion for what I was experiencing in that moment. And when a condemned person feels the need to show you compassion because they're worried about you, it changes your sense of what it means to stand with the condemned. And proximity will do that. It will teach you things about what it means to be engaged with people who are disfavored, people who are disadvantaged, people who are marginalized, and it will teach you things about what it means to stand up. And so I believe we actually have to learn how to get proximate to the things that matter. Well, proximity isn't the only thing that I think is necessary to confront injustice. I also think that we have to be willing to change the narrative, to learn how to change the narrative. In this country, there are narratives being presented to us all the time. And these narratives can be very destructive. It will make sense to you that we put people away in prison for decades if you listen to the narratives. It'll make sense to you that we don't do very much about income inequality. We don't do very much about protecting the environment. We don't do very much about gender equality. We don't do very much because of these narratives, and I believe we have to change the narrative. The latest project at EJI is really a project about race and poverty. I'm very interested in changing the narrative about racial justice in this country. In my view, we've done very little to confront the legacy of racial inequality. This country was rooted in the institution of slavery. When I think about the institutions that have shaped Americans and African Americans in particular, I see these four institutions. I see slavery. And the legacy of slavery is devastating. Slavery in America wasn't like slavery in other parts of the world. In other parts of the world, slavery was usually a transient state. It could happen to anybody. You could get into economic conditions. You could be the prisoner of war. You could be occupied by a foreign power, and you could be enslaved, but it wasn't who you were. In America, we made slavery a status inexorably tied to race. We even defended it by arguing that some people deserved, would actually benefit from being enslaved by us. And this narrative about racial difference and racial inequality and racial distinctions became a part of our legacy, our history. And sadly, we haven't owned up to that history. We haven't owned up to that legacy. And that institution continues to haunt us. I see it all the time. Well, the second institution actually began at the end of Reconstruction and continued until World War II, and it was the institution of racial terrorism. It's terrorism that defined the lives of people of color in most of this country between Reconstruction and World War II. It was the threat of lynching and bombings and convict leasing and all kinds of mass violence directed at people of color that terrorized people into submitting to racial subordination. And if you don't understand that, you should come to where I practice, where you meet these older people of color. I meet older people of color all the time. They come up to me and they say, Mr. Stevenson, I get so upset when I hear people on TV talking about how we're dealing with domestic terrorism in this country for the first time after 9/11. They say, it makes me angry when I hear that. They say, we grew up with terrorism. We had to worry about being bombed. We had to worry about being shot. We had to worry about being lynched. We had to worry about all of this violence. And sometimes they'll say to me, they say, Mr. Stevenson, you give these talks, you make people stop saying that. And this era of terror has created huge challenges for us, huge challenges that we haven't confronted. It's funny, I talk about this. I gave some lectures in Germany not too long ago about the death penalty and the racial bias of the death penalty. And I talked about the legacy of lynching and racial discrimination and bias. And when I finished, the German scholar at one of the lectures got up and said, well, of course, we don't have the death penalty in Germany currently. And I think I can speak for everybody in this room. We are very committed to never having the death penalty again. In fact, she said, we can never engage in the systematic killing of human beings in the nation state of Germany. It would be shameful. It would be unconscionable for us, given our history of the Holocaust, to ever engage in that kind of killing. And people were silently nodding. And on my flight back to the U.S., I started thinking about that. I started thinking, what would it feel like to live in a world where the nation state of Germany was still putting people in gas chambers and executing them? Would it make a difference if they had committed a crime? It wouldn't for me. I realized that in that world, I'd have to be saying something. I'd have to be doing something. And then I started thinking about it even more. What would it feel like if the people that the nation state of Germany were executing were disproportionately Jewish? And the more I reflected on that, the more I realized I couldn't be quiet in such a world. And then I got off the plane in Alabama, and I walked back to my office, where buried in the ground are the bodies of thousands of people who had been lynched and murdered and the victims of racial violence and terror. And then I went to death row, where 80% of the people on death row are there for crimes involving victims who are white. And I thought, how is it that we can do these things? Well, we can do these things because we haven't confronted that history. And we've got to change that narrative. The third institution, of course, segregation, apartheid, Jim Crow. As I mentioned, I am a product of the civil rights movement. I remember when the lawyers came into our community. That legacy has been profound, very profound. And yet we haven't really talked about it. We had some laws change in the 1960s, but we didn't commit ourselves to a process of truth and reconciliation. We didn't actually sit down and tell the truth about what decades of racial violence and trauma and humiliation and segregation had done to us. And not just people of color, to everybody. We have a generation of people, many of whom are in power, that were taught as children that they are better than everybody else because they're white. And we didn't teach them how to get past that, to overcome that. We just kind of assumed that they'd find their way. And that's created these tensions, and the trust is tangible. And then, of course, the fourth institution is mass incarceration, the way in which we've actually created a system that targets poor people and people of color and exploits their vulnerability, exploits their legacy of disadvantage and marginalization, and turns it into a crime. And the presumptions of guilt that follow that have created a need for us to change the narrative. Now, we need to commit ourselves to truth and reconciliation in this country. We will not make progress. We will not succeed until we tell the truth about what our racial conflict is. We won't make progress until we tell the truth about what we have done to Native people, to what we have done to Japanese Americans during World War II, to what we have done to immigrants and new communities that have come to this country and have been criminalized and presumed guilty because of their ethnicity. And so for me, it becomes necessary to change the narrative. And changing the narrative is hard. It's hard. Liliana mentioned that we've been doing work for children. Our big project is actually focused on challenging these death in prison sentences that we impose on children. The United States is the only country in the world that condemns children, some as young as 13 years of age, to die in prison. We have 3,000 kids in the United States sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. We have 10,000 children in the United States that right now are under the age of 18 being housed in adult jails or prisons, where they're 5 times more likely to be the victims of sexual assault, but 7 times more likely to commit suicide. We have 250,000 people in prison who were sentenced to very long prison sentences while they were under the age of 18. And changing the narrative becomes essential. And these things go together. When you get close to these problems, the need to change the narrative becomes essential. I worked on a case involving a child not that long ago. A little boy was living in a house where his mother had been the target of a lot of domestic violence. This boy was about 14 years of age. And his mother had a boyfriend who was at times quite abusive. And she'd been hospitalized a few times after these incidents of domestic violence. And one day, they were together, the boy and his mother, playing cards. And the man came home, and he was drunk. And when he walked into the house, he called for the mother. And because he was drunk, he didn't even explain himself. He was just angry at the world. And his mother walked into the kitchen, and the man just, for no reason, hauled off and punched her in the face, knocked her unconscious. She fell on the floor. The man went into a bedroom and fell asleep. This little boy went over to his mother and tried to revive her, and she was bleeding. She wouldn't wake up. And he tried for 20 minutes to get her to wake up, and he couldn't. And this little boy actually thought his mom was dead. The man had gone into the bedroom and fallen asleep, and he was sleeping on the bed, and this little boy got up, and he walked into the bedroom. He was a good kid. He'd never been in trouble before, had a good school record, never had a juvenile arrest or anything, was a young kid, a small kid, about 5 feet tall, under 100 pounds. But he walked into the bedroom, and he walked over to the dresser where he knew this man kept his handgun. And he opened the dresser drawer, and he pulled out this handgun, and he walked over to where the man was sleeping. And this little child could hear this man snoring, and he pointed the gun at the man's head. And he was shaking while he was holding this gun, and the man was snoring, and then the snoring stopped, and this little boy did something very tragic. He pulled the trigger and shot this man in the head. The man died almost instantly. And because this child had no prior juvenile history and because he'd never been in trouble before, he probably would have been tried as a juvenile but for the fact that the man that he shot and killed, his mother's boyfriend, was a deputy sheriff. And because he was a deputy sheriff, the prosecutor insisted that this child be tried as an adult. And the judge certified him to stand trial as an adult, and they immediately placed him in the adult jail. His grandmother called me about 3 days later and said, "I want you to work on this case, my grandson's case." I tried to get out of it, but she was very persuasive. And I said, "Okay, I'll go over and I'll go see your grandson." And I went down to this county to see this little boy, and I had one of these very difficult encounters. I walked into the jail, and they brought out this little boy, and I was startled to see how small he was. And I started asking him questions, but no matter what I asked him, he wouldn't say a word. He kept staring at the wall, and I kept asking questions, and he kept staring at the wall. He just kept staring. And finally, I put my pen down. I said, "Look, I can't help you if you don't answer my questions. You got to talk to me." He kept staring. About 20 minutes went by, and I got up, and I walked around the table, and I pulled my chair close to him. I said, "Look, you got to talk to me. I can't help you if you don't talk to me." And he kept staring at the wall. And finally, I got real close to him, and at one point, just started leaning on him. And after I did that a few times, at one point, he leaned back. And when he leaned back, I put my arm around him. I said, "Come on, you got to talk to me. I can't help you if you don't talk to me. Tell me what's going on." And then this boy fell into me, and he started crying almost hysterically. And through his tears, he began talking to me not about what happened with his mom, not about what happened with the man, but he started talking to me about what had happened at the jail. And he told me on the first night that he'd been assaulted by several men. And then he told me on the next night he'd actually been raped by several people. He told me on the night before I'd gotten there, so many people had hurt him, he couldn't actually remember how many there had been. And I held this little boy while he cried hysterically for almost an hour. And when I left that jail, I couldn't help but think, who is responsible for this? And I realized, we are. We've allowed a narrative about child culpability to emerge to the point where we have actually done the unthinkable. In the late 1980s, criminologists began talking about how there were some children that aren't really children. And these criminologists said that these kids may look like kids and they may seem like kids, but they're not really kids. And these criminologists told legislators that these children are, quote, super predators. And that was the language that they used. And every state lowered the minimum age for trying children as adults. We began to send tens and tens of thousands of kids to adult jails and prisons. And changing the narrative is going to be essential to changing that reality. I told that story about that little boy at a church conference several months later, and a family came up and they said, "We cannot make peace until we do something to help that child." And they were just relentless, and I tried to play them off, but they were persistent. And finally, I connected them with this little boy, and they ultimately adopted him, and I'm very pleased to report he's doing wonderfully well. We got him back into the juvenile system and got him out very shortly after that, and he's recently just finished college and is doing really, really well. But it would not have happened without these people embracing him. Well, the third thing I think we have to talk about, I should have warned you a little bit earlier, these things get a little harder as I go along. I'm sorry about that. The third thing I think we actually have to confront if we're going to do something about the injustice around us, I think we actually have to be willing to be hopeful. Now, you wouldn't think that being hopeful is a hard thing, but actually being hopeful is a very hard thing. Because being hopeful means actually choosing to do things that other people think don't make sense, other people think won't make a difference. Choosing to be hopeful is actually a very difficult thing. Vaclav Havel, the great Czech leader, talks about this. Havel said that in Europe, in the 1960s, when they were fighting against Soviet domination, they wanted all kinds of things. They wanted the recognition of other governments. They wanted money. They wanted resources. They wanted intervention from the West. They wanted all of these things. But the only thing they absolutely needed, the only thing they absolutely had to have, was hope. And Havel says the kind of hope we need to make a difference, to kind of confront inequality and injustice, isn't that pie in the sky thing. It's not a preference for optimism over pessimism. Havel says the kind of hope we need to become world changers is rather an orientation of the spirit, a willingness to sometimes position ourselves in very hopeless places and be a witness, to say something, to do something, even when it may not seem rational. And I think he's right. And being hopeful can be very, very difficult. I'll be honest with you, and we've got this new project, we've been putting up markers about slavery, we've got a project where we're working on trying to educate this country about the legacy of lynching, we've been talking about this era of racial violence and terror, we've been trying to dramatize the trauma and the suffering that so many people in our community have been carrying around with them as a result of inequality and injustice. And in working on it, I've had to own up to some things, and I have to own up to the fact that I am kind of a little impaired. I get really unhappy when I hear this rhetoric about the good old days. I don't like it when people talk romantically about the old South. I don't like the images of the old South. The Confederate flag upsets me. I don't like these images that try to glorify this era when there was enslavement and terror and violence and horrific humiliation of people of color, and I don't do well. I can't say that I'm not distracted by it because I am. And I was going to a prison not that long ago to go see a client I'd never seen before, and I got to the prison, and outside the prison was this truck, and this truck had all of these Confederate flags on it. It had all of these bumper stickers and the gun rack, and it was like a shrine to the old South. I saw bumper stickers on this truck I'd never seen before. One of the bumper stickers read, quote, "If I'd known it was going to be like this, I'd have picked my own cotton." Hadn't seen that one before. And I was really disrupted by it, and I was kind of trying to say, look, Brian, you can't worry about that. You got to go in here and meet your client. Don't get distracted. Go in there, deal with your client. And I said, okay. And I walked into the prison, and I walked in, and there was a guard there I'd never seen before, and this guard saw me coming. And I stopped and I said, hello. He said, are you here for a legal visit? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, you're going to get in that bathroom. I'm going to give you a strip search. I said, oh, no, sir. Lawyers don't have to be strip searched for legal visits. He said, well, I'm the person on charge today. And if you're coming into my prison, you're going to go in that bathroom and get a strip search. And I looked around for someone to complain to, and there was no one. And I said, well, I have to see this client. And so I did. Went into the bathroom, was treated horrifically by this officer. When I came out, I was trying to reclaim some dignity, so I said, look, I want to go see my client now. He said, well, you got to go back there and sign that book. I said, lawyers don't have to sign that book. He said, if you're coming into my prison, you're going to sign that book. And so I did. I went back and signed the book. Never had to do it before. I said, I want to see my client now after I did that. And he took me over to the door, and he unlocked the door, and he was about to open the door. Then he stopped, and he turned to me, and he said, hey, did you see that truck out there with all those flags and bumper stickers? I said, yeah, I saw that truck. He said, I want you to know that that's my truck. Really nasty, really unnerving. Tried not to think about it, but I was really distracted by it. Went into the prison, sat down, was waiting for this client I'd never met before. The client was quite mentally ill. The client finally came out, African-American man. He sat down, and he turned to me, and he said, did you bring me a chocolate milkshake? I thought to myself, this is the strangest day I've had in a really long time. I said, no, I didn't bring you a chocolate milkshake. I'm your lawyer. I'm here to talk about legal matters. And I started asking my questions, and the man wasn't with me. He was very distracted. And I realized he's still hung up on this. I said, look, I'm sorry. I didn't know you wanted me to bring you a chocolate milkshake. The next time I come, if they let me, I'll bring you a chocolate milkshake. Very, very disabled person. Very, very impaired. Had a horrific background. Grew up in the foster care system where he'd been terribly abused. When he was 10 years old, his foster parents actually took him out into the woods, tied him to a tree, and left him there. He was found several days later by hunters. By the time he was 12, he was quite ill, drug addicted. By the time he was 14, psychotic. By 16, homeless, roaming the streets at 19, and then committed a very, very tragic crime at the age of 20. He went to trial with a bad lawyer. We have a criminal justice system in this country that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. And his inability to get adequate legal assistance left him exposed to the death penalty. And nobody knew anything about his background or his mental illness. They just convicted him and put him on death row. And every time I went to see him, I had to explain to him that I tried to bring him a milkshake. He was preoccupied with this milkshake. He'd been in a home when he was a child and had gotten in trouble over a milkshake, and it was just one of those things that kind of was floating, cycling, circling in his mind. And after a few months, we'd actually prepared a pretty good case to help challenge his conviction, his sentence, where we had some mental health experts who were prepared to testify, and it was time to go to court. And we went to the courthouse, and I felt good about our case. We had some good experts ready. And when I got to court, there was my client. I went through my ritual about explaining how I tried to bring a milkshake, but they wouldn't let me, and he was fine after that. And then I turned around and saw that this guard who had been so mean to me, so nasty to me, was the guard who had brought him to the court. And I asked him if he was okay, and the client seemed fine. And we had a good week of hearings, 3 days of hearings. Our experts testified well, the witnesses testified well, and at the end of the hearing, I felt hopeful about this case. And finally, about a month after that hearing, it was time to go back to the prison to see this client for the first time. And I went back to the prison, and I saw the truck in the parking lot, which made me a little nervous. And then I got to the front of the prison, and there was this guard. I thought to myself, oh, God, I got to deal with this guy. And I walked inside, and as soon as I walked inside, the guard turned to me, and he said, hello, Mr. Stevenson, how are you? Kind of threw me. I said, I'm fine. I said, I'll go in the bathroom and get ready for your search. He said, oh, Mr. Stevenson, I don't need to do that. Don't worry about that. I said, okay. I said, well, I'll go back here and sign the book. He said, Mr. Stevenson, I saw you coming, and I signed you in. Really turned me around. I said, well, thank you. I said, well, I guess I'll go see my client. And he walked over to the door, and he unlocked the door, and he stood there, and I saw him get really nervous. And then finally he turned to me, and he said, Mr. Stevenson, I want to say something to you. And I didn't know what to expect. And this man was actually shaking. And then he finally said, I want you to know that I think what you're doing is a good thing. Could have floored me. I said, well, thank you. He says, no, I really mean it. I said, I think what you're doing is a good thing. He said, I was listening in that courtroom. He said, I've had it hard too. I grew up in foster care too. And I thought nobody had it as bad as me, but I realized that that's not true. He said, I've got some issues, but I want you to know that I think what you're doing is a good thing. Completely turned me around. And I tell you that because it's important that we be hopeful about what we can achieve, even when it doesn't look like hopefulness makes sense. He opened the door to let me back into the prison, and he stopped me before he went. I went in, he grabbed me by the arm. He said, I got to tell you one more thing. I said, what's that? He said, well, I just want you to know that I did something when I came back from the courthouse and brought your client back to the prison. I said, what'd you do? He said, well, at one point, I just decided to take an exit. And I took your client to a Wendy's, and I bought him a chocolate milkshake. It's a really silly story, but it speaks to the power of what can happen when we position ourselves and we say things that need to be said, and we allow ourselves to be hopeful about what we can do. Hopelessness is the essential ingredient of injustice. Where hopelessness prevails, you'll see all kinds of inequality, all kinds of mistreatment, all kinds of abuse, all kinds of suffering. And somebody has to always be willing to be that witness for hope. Well, the fourth thing is the hardest thing. And it's even hard sometimes for me to talk about it. But the fourth thing is that I actually believe if we're really committed to creating a just community, a just society, a just world, if we're really going to make a difference, if we're really going to stand up to these things, we actually have to be willing to commit ourselves to being uncomfortable. Now, being uncomfortable is really, really difficult. Human beings are programmed to seek comfort. We all want to go to the places where we feel welcome. We all like to go to the spaces where things feel right. We all like comfort. I like comfort. I went to give a talk in southern Mississippi, and I got down there, and the organizers came up to me, and they said, Mr. Stevenson, we respect you so much, and we know so much about your work, and we know what kind of person you are. And we realized that we weren't going to insult you in any kind of way. And so we got you a room at the Motel 6. We didn't put you in the DoubleTree because we understand where your values are. And I thought to myself, what is wrong with you? I want the DoubleTree. I like the chocolate chip cookie. Don't put me. We all like comfort. And there are times when we have to be really, really focused on making sure that there is that comfort we need. But sometimes we actually have to decide to do what's uncomfortable. Sometimes we have to be intentionally uncomfortable, put ourselves in difficult places, situate ourselves in places that don't feel very welcoming, say things that are very difficult, do things that are uncomfortable. Sometimes we have to be the person who speaks when everybody else is quiet. Sometimes we have to be the person who stands when everybody else remains sitting. And it's that discomfort that I think is essential to creating justice, to changing the world. And without it, unfortunately, sadly, we will not get there. We won't. You think about the great movements around the world that have achieved things. People are celebrating the civil rights movement. They like the image of Dr. King standing in front of all of those people, in front of the Lincoln Memorial. That's a glorious image. That's not uncomfortable. But the images that they need to be reflecting on is Dr. King being hauled away with his arm twisted behind his back by police officers, taken to jails, forgotten in Reedsville State Prison, being attacked, being bombed, being threatened, being stabbed. That's the uncomfortable part. And without it, unfortunately, we cannot get the things to happen that must happen. It's an evolving lesson. I've been doing this work for a long time, and I'm only now recently recognizing the importance of sometimes being willing to say, yes, I'm going to do this uncomfortable thing. You know, representing people on death row can be very challenging, lots of uncomfortable moments in that. I've been doing it a while, and I've actually felt like I'd gotten to the point where I could really manage just about anything. And about 3 years ago, Alabama had the highest execution rate in the country. We had executions every other month. And our project is a small project. We don't have a public defender system in the state. Most of the people on death row don't have lawyers when it gets to the point where they've exhausted their appeals. And we made a decision to stand with every condemned person. We weren't going to let anybody face execution alone. We were going to get in there and fight for them till the very last minute. And I took my young lawyers, and I said, we're going to have to do this. It's going to be very difficult, but we're going to do it. And I was trying to get them ready. I felt like they need that help. I knew what I was doing. I felt like it wasn't going to be hard for me. And after the fifth or sixth execution that year, it felt like we were dealing with this problem every other month. I found myself one night talking to somebody right before the execution. And even though I'd done it before, I found myself experiencing things I hadn't experienced in a really long time. I just felt overwhelmed. And this man was talking to me. It was about 30 minutes before the scheduled execution. And he was just trying to tell me how grateful he was that we fought for him, that we came to his aid, that we tried to do something for him. And there was something about the way he was talking to me that was just breaking my heart. The man had a very severe speech impediment, and he couldn't really get his words out. He was trying, but the closer we got to the execution, the more his anxiety level was increasing, the harder it was for him to talk. And he kept trying, and he kept trying, and he kept trying, and the harder he tried, the more overwhelming it was for me. And I was sitting there holding this phone and started thinking about things that I'd been dealing with and things I'd been thinking about, and I started thinking about when I was a little boy. And when I was a little boy, my mother used to take me to church, and I remembered this day when we went to church one Sunday, and my brother and I were talking to some other kids that we always talk to, and one of these other kids had brought a cousin or a family relative to church who had never been there before. And I asked this little boy a question. When I asked this boy a question, he couldn't get his words out. He had a very severe speech impediment. He was stuttering really, really poorly. And because I was young and foolish and had never met anybody who was dealing with that issue, and when this boy tried to talk and he couldn't get his words out, I did something really ignorant. I laughed. And my mother was standing across the room, and she saw me laughing at this boy. My mom gave me a look I'd never seen before. And she gave me this really intense, menacing look, and she called me over, and she grabbed me by the arm, and she said, Brian, don't you ever laugh at somebody because they can't get their words out right. Don't you ever do that. And then she told me, she said, now you go back over there, and you tell that little boy that you are sorry. And then she said, I want you to hug that little boy. And then she said, I want you to tell that little boy that you love him. I said, Mom, I can go over there and say I'm sorry, and maybe. And then she gave me that look again, so I said, okay. And I went over to this little boy, and I went up to him, and I said, look, man, I'm sorry. And I gave him my little 9-year-old version of a man hug. And then I said as insincerely as I possibly could, I love you. And I never will forget this child squeezing me tight and without a flaw, without a pause, whispering in my ear, I love you too. Never saw him before, never saw him again. But I was holding the phone, listening to this condemned man try to get his words out right, and I thought about that, and all of a sudden, it just seemed too much, too much. Got close to the time for the execution. I could hear the guards making noise, and finally, he got out his words. He said, Mr. Stevenson, I just want you to know I love you for trying to stand for me, for fighting for me. It makes all the difference in the world. And then he hung up. And I put the phone down, and I thought to myself, I can't do this anymore. It's too much, too hard. Don't want to do it anymore. Too much, too hard. I said, that man is broken, and we're going to kill him. And I started asking myself these hard questions. Why do we want to kill all the broken people in this country? Why do we try to kill brokenness when we find it? And then I realized how my life is surrounded by brokenness. Broken clients, broken system of justice, broken families, people broken by poverty, people broken by racism, people broken by disability, people broken by inequality, people broken by all kinds of things. Broken, broken, broken. A voice in my head was saying, Brian, you need to get away from this brokenness. It's too much. And that's when you have to have those hard conversations with you, that you have with yourself, when you ask yourself, well, why are you doing what you're doing? And I was in that space, one of these critical spaces. I started asking myself, well, why am I doing this? And then I realized something I hadn't realized before. I started asking myself those questions. And I realized that, you know, I really don't do this because I think it's important. And all of a sudden, I started realizing things. I said, I guess I don't really do this even because I think it needs to be done. And the more I thought about it, the kind of deeper the insight was, and I started realizing, yes, I don't. I don't do this because it's important. I don't do it because I think it has to be done. I don't do it because I think I can. I don't do it because I get to kind of go places and talk to really amazing people. I don't do it because there's money, because there's not much money. I don't do it because there's opportunity to kind of be stimulated. I realized something in that moment that I hadn't realized before. I realize that I don't do what I do because I've been trained to do it. I don't do what I do because I have to do it. I don't do what I do because I can do it. I don't do what I do because it needs to be done. I realize in that moment that I do what I do because I'm broken too. And that's what proximity to inequality, that's what proximity to injustice, that's what proximity to suffering will do. If you're desperately trying to change the narrative, it will disrupt you. When you're trying to be hopeful, when hopefulness doesn't make sense, it will get to you. When you're standing up, when everybody else is sitting, when you're speaking, when everybody else is quiet, there will be these cracks, these little fractures, these little tears. But then I also realized that there's power in brokenness. It's when you're broken that you hear things that you can't otherwise hear. It's when you're broken that you see things that you cannot otherwise see. And it's in that moment that I realized that I don't represent the condemned. I don't represent children who've been condemned. I don't represent people who've been broken. I don't represent people who've been thrown away. I don't represent the disfavored. I don't represent the poor or the people of color or the discarded. I represent myself and the community of broken people. And I believe that there are lots of broken people in all kinds of places, broken by their discomfort with inequality, broken by their discomfort with injustice, broken by their discomfort with the way in which we treat the poor, we treat the disadvantaged, we treat racial minorities, we treat those who are just as valuable as we are. It's in brokenness that I've learned some very simple things. I do believe that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I think if somebody tells a lie, they're not just a liar. I think if somebody takes something that doesn't belong to them, they're not just a thief. I think even if you kill somebody, you're not just a killer. And because of that, there's got to be somebody to stand up and defend you, to kind of speak to all the other things you are, to protect your basic human rights. But this country has been broken by a legacy of inequality, a legacy of racial bias, a legacy of poverty. I don't believe in America that the opposite of poverty is wealth. I don't think that. We focus too much on trying to get money here and trying to get money there and trying to do this here and trying to do that there. I don't think that the opposite of poverty is wealth. For me, the opposite of poverty is justice. And when we commit ourselves to justice, that's when we create opportunities to deconstruct poverty. And finally, I believe that you don't judge the character of a community. You don't judge the quality of life in a society. You don't judge the civility of a place by how you treat the powerful and the rich and the privileged. You judge the character of a society by how you treat the poor, the condemned, the incarcerated. And it's because of that that there is this need to be willfully uncomfortable in the service of something important. And I'm now realizing that I am a survivor of brokenness. It is not just kind of where I've situated myself, but it's where I feel like I need to be. And there's power in that. There's energy in that. I had the great privilege, I tell this story a lot, I had the great privilege of knowing Rosa Parks. Learned a lot of things from her. She would come back to Montgomery every now and then. She lived in Detroit, but she'd come back to Montgomery, and her two closest friends were these amazing women. Johnny Carr, who was the architect of the Montgomery bus boycott. Ms. Carr was just a force. Even in her 90s, she was such a powerful person. And she would get in, she'd call me up and she'd say, I need you to be here, I need you to be there. And I'd say, yes, ma'am. And she said, and I'll be looking for you. If you're not there, I'm going to call you again. I'd say, okay. And she would sometimes call me up. And then Virginia Durr was another friend of Rosa Parks. Virginia Durr's husband, Clifford Durr, represented Dr. King. Ms. Durr was an older white woman, was also just strong and powerful and influential. And Ms. Carr would call me up and she'd say, Brian, Ms. Parks is coming to town, and me and Ms. Durr and Ms. Parks are going to get together and talk. She said, now I'll let you come over. Do you want to come over and listen? And I'd say, oh, yes, ma'am. And then she'd always say, now tell me, Brian, what does the word listen mean? And I explained to her that I knew that I wasn't supposed to say a word. And I would. I'd go over there and I would just listen. And she'd tell me where to sit, and I'd sit right there. And I'd listen to these women talk, and it was so amazing to me because they always talked about what they were going to do. They rarely talked about what they had done. They were always talking about what they were going to do. And they would get into these incredible conversations, and it was always so energizing. And I was over there one time, and I'd been listening to them talk for 2 hours, and I was just soaking it all in. And finally, Ms. Parks turned to me, and she said, now, Brian, tell me what the Equal Justice Initiative is. Tell me what you're trying to do. And I looked at Ms. Carr to see if I had permission to speak, and she nodded, and so I gave her my rap. I said, well, we're trying to do something about ending the death penalty. We want to eliminate mass incarceration. We want to help children prosecuted as adults. We're trying to do something to equalize our criminal justice system and help the poor, do something about conditions of confinement, do something about rural poverty, do something about racial bias and the legacy of discrimination and Jim Crow, do something about the unfairness and all of these things. I gave her my whole rap, and when I finished, she looked at me. She said, She said, that's going to make you tired, tired, tired. And that's when Ms. Carr leaned forward and she put her finger in my face and she said, that's why you've got to be brave, brave, brave. It takes courage sometimes to make the choice to be uncomfortable, to make the choice to be proximate, to make the choice to be hopeful. But when I see great art, when I see great beauty, when I see the kind of great things that I see in a place like Santa Fe, I'm actually persuaded that art and beauty take courage. It also takes proximity. It also means kind of finding a narrative that you can change. It also requires some hopefulness to believe that what you do matters. And that's why I believe it's in communities like this that we begin to say the things that make a difference. We begin to do the things that deconstruct mass incarceration. We begin to do the things that equalize our society and income inequality. We begin to do the things to create a narrative that allows us to confront our history of racial inequality and racial injustice. And it's because of that that it's a real privilege for me to have this opportunity to be here, to be in this space with you, to have this opportunity to share, and to mostly recognize that this community of broken people, all of us, have so much more to do, have so much more to gain, and have so much more to say. There is, in my community, when I was a young boy coming up, it would sometimes always be energizing. One of the people ask me today, well, who inspires you? And I realize in thinking about that a little bit later that the people who inspire me who are the people who hope when they have the least amount to hope for, the people who get close when they have the most to lose by getting close, the people who seem to kind of embrace discomfort even when it seems like they're doing that all the time. And when I was a young kid, I'd go to my church and I'd see these older people stand up after something terrible had happened to them, after something really difficult had happened to them, and they would start singing this song about, I wouldn't take nothing for my journey now. And I come here this evening and I see the hopefulness and the beauty and the courage and the energy and the spirit in this community. And it makes me want to go back to Alabama singing, I wouldn't take nothing for my journey now, because I do know there is a community of people in this country who are prepared to stand and fight and claim and push for the kind of justice that we so desperately need. And for that, I thank you.
And that was Brian Stevenson, founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. He is a professor at New York University School of Law, and he spoke earlier this year at the Lenzic here in Santa Fe, sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. You can go to lannan.org for more information, and also to hear the introduction and conversation with journalist Liliana Segura.